In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. The digital technology that was designed to meaningfully connect people has created a landscape of passive users who have unwittingly become the product. A recent survey finds that 42% of the time Americans are awake, their eyes are fixated on a screen, either television, smartphones, computers, tablets, or other devices. Can humans reconnect to their true social nature and reignite visions of their many possible futures, or will human dreams be extinguished by artificial intelligence? Our guest, award-winning author Douglas Rushkoff, points out how neuroscientists have confirmed that humans need input from organic three-dimensional space in order to establish trusting relationships. In his newly published book, Team Human, Rushkoff says it's time to intervene on our own behalf and return to facing each other, literally in business, education, diplomacy, and romance. Douglas Rushkoff is also a media theorist and broadcaster. He hosts the podcast Team Human and has written 20 books, including Present Shock, Media Virus, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, and Siberia. Rushkoff has originated concepts such as viral media and social currency. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome to Another News.
Thanks for having me.
Team Human is a brilliant book. You compressed a lot of important turning points in the human involvement with technology in the last 30 years that has delivered us to a place where we have nearly infinite information at our fingertips, yet society appears more restless and passive and repressed. Is this a side effect of weaponized media and autonomous technologies?
Well, I mean, in some ways, weaponized media is a result of living in a world like this, you know, where if people really feel like they can't turn to one another anymore, if other people become really marks in a game, then we're going to be looking at people as others whom we need to manipulate to get what we need, rather than, you know, allies or comrades or a part of a cohort that we're in a game with together. Digital technology has, correct, it has put a whole lot of information at our fingertips, but most people are not using the internet as like one big Wikipedia, the way we may have imagined it, you know, back in the day. It's not, you know, people with text browsers downloading files from universities. It's people on various social media platforms judging each other's hotness and siding against them. You know, it is true that the way our social media platforms are set up, because they're so visual and so judgmental and so alienated, because they really do depend on isolating and atomizing us in order to market to us and manipulate us, that the sort of social and research and intellectual function of the net really has given way to a very much more kind of competitive, self-driven way of looking at it. And yeah, that makes us both in work more likely to be part of some company or project that's going to use weaponized memetics on someone else, that's going to say, okay, how do we get our customers to buy this? How do we get people to think this way? How do we get those ones to vote that way? And once you're talking about getting people to do something by any means necessary, using technology on people, well, then we've kind of got the cart and the horse reversed. You know, then we're playing people with technology rather than letting people play with technology. You know, we're turning the tools on ourselves rather than seeing the tools as an extension of who we are and what we do.
And that gets into the basic design of the economic design in the system.
Yeah, I mean, we used digital technology to pump steroids into a dying corporate capitalist economic model. You know, really, if you do your kind of recent economic history, in 1987, there was a giant crash, the biotech crash on the NASDAQ stock exchange. A lot of people didn't know if we were going to recover. And then the internet came along, and even though no one really knew how to make money off it, because people are just sort of talking to each other and having fun and going on chat boards, it became the poster child for what we call the long boom, you know, the new stock market expansion that even Alan Greenspan at the time said, well, this might just go on forever. The rules are changed. You know, the dream of finding a technology that would supply infinite, expansive innovations was born. You know, but that's also when we turned the internet from this almost a relief from corporate capitalism, a relief from work and competition and all those things that really drive us crazy. We turned from a respite from that into an extension of that. So yeah, so we've taken all of these tools and said, how can we use them to explode business plans by any means necessary? So human attention becomes a new resource. We can't enslave more people in Africa or China, but we can expand and we can commandeer people's psyche right here at home. So even if there's no more land to exploit, there's no more territories to take over, human attention became the new surface area for the market. So they mined our attention. And what had been, gosh, in the old days, we used to say, I'm going to go online. It was a discrete experience. I'm going to go online and do these things and then come offline and be in the world. Going online became a permanent state. We strap these devices to our bodies and have them interrupt us at, you know, anytime someone tweets about us or sends an instant message or something. We live in this state of kind of perpetual emergency interruption that used to be endured only by, you know, 911 operators or air traffic controllers. And now, you know, we pay for the privilege of living in that constantly distracted nightmare state. And that's not because we're saying, let's use technology to really enhance and promote our humanity and solve our real problems we have as a civilization. It's because we're saying, let's figure out how we can use technology to deliver money to shareholders of these very short-term thinking companies.
Right. You said stocks are the product as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, most digital companies, they're not thinking in terms of what value am I creating for my user. No, they're thinking what value am I creating for my shareholder. So the product of the company, the product of a Google or an Amazon is the shares. That's what they're selling. I mean, honestly, once any company goes public, and this is what people don't realize, once you go public, you've sold your company. That's what you did. You sold the company. You sold out, literally sold out. And at that point, it is. It's just like when the mob owns your bar or restaurant, that now you're working for them. And the only thing they care about is the price on those shares. They don't even, sadly, if they just cared about the revenue the shares were getting, if they were getting dividends and happy with those, it would be great. But shareholders don't want dividends. Dividends are taxed high. Capital gains, meaning the growth of the shares, that's taxed low. That's what they've bargained for. That's what they lobbied for, because they don't want to own a company that's providing goods or services to people, that has to answer to customers or the government or the environment. They want quick, you know, like throwing gasoline on a charcoal grill. They want that heat, and then they sell.
So the tax laws are in place to encourage that business action?
Yeah. I mean, the tax laws punish those who earn money. They actually do. Payroll tax is high. Dividend tax is high. Anybody in the working real economy, anybody who's the economic term would be, you know, anybody who's encouraging the velocity of transactions, the flow of money through the system, that's punished. Right? That's taxed high. The thing that's rewarded with low taxes is when you extract money from the system, when you get your money in your share price, when you trap money. You know, and the problem is the wealthiest corporations, well, really all corporations, are getting obese. They're cash rich. They don't know what to do with all the money. If you look at the actual figures over the past 75 years, corporate profit over corporate size has been going down consistently for 75 years. It's not just the internet. What does that mean? Corporate profit over size. It means that they're really good at taking all the money off the table, but really bad at deploying it. They just become these kind of obese, behemoth, you know, nightmarishly large companies. The only way they know how to make money after that is by buying up smaller companies. Even Google, which started as, what, two kids in a Stanford dorm room with a good algorithm that was going to take down Yahoo, it's become so big it's not even Google. Google became Alphabet. Alphabet is called a holding company. And what that means, a holding company is a company that makes its money not through its goods and services, but by buying and selling other companies. That's the way people do business now. That's what Jack Welch, the famous CEO of GE, what he realized in the 80s was, oh, shoot, you know, we make less money making a washing machine and selling it to someone than we do lending them the money they need to buy the washing machine. So screw this thing where we make stuff and have to get materials and labor and workers. Let's just become a bank. So he sold off their productive assets, their industrial assets, in order to turn GE into a bank. And that worked right up until around 2007, 2008, when there was that big banking crisis and crash. And now GE, people are talking about whether or not it's even going to survive now.
The businesses move more toward an abstraction, the holding companies. It may lend to this. Everything we do now in this digital reality is stored and used for marketing analysis. That includes our real-time behavior, such as connected appliances and GPS. And an interesting example is Sidewalk Labs in Toronto, Canada. It's a community designed to be a wireless environment where light posts, street signs, appliances, the infrastructure is gathering data on residents. But late last year, one of the top privacy experts overseeing the project quit because a third party contracted to build the systems wouldn't sign the privacy agreement. How does this connect back to what you were describing in terms of the what corporations are doing now?
Well, let me think of it this way. You know, corporations found out that if they get us online, they can manipulate us in all sorts of new weird ways. It's this perfect environment for social control, the people out online. And they had all of these great learnings about, you know, how to make people more efficient and utilitarian and how to make them do this and how to make them do that. What we're seeing now in efforts like Sidewalk or even to some extent in something like WeWork, these co-working spaces, is them saying, well, what if we apply all this stuff that we learned online back in the real world? Why can't we make the real world more like the internet? Because people are so easy to manipulate and to track them to this clickbait or that, or convince them with this autonomous meme or that. We can observe every one of their behaviors online, every click, every mouse drag, everything that they do. So why don't we just do all that in the real world? So now instead of looking at their keystrokes, we're going to look at their footsteps. Instead of looking at what they say, we're going to look at their breathing. We're going to look at where they eat, at where they poop, at everything. And that to me is a real nightmare scenario, because really what they're figuring out how to do, online anyway, is how to disconnect us from the core instincts that we've developed over hundreds of thousands of years in order to function in a healthy, smart, connected, autonomous way. They're really good at disconnecting us from that online and appealing to our amygdala in our brainstem and getting us to behave impulsively and vote impulsively, to see Mexicans as rapists. Oh my gosh. You know, it's really easy to do that to people online. You show them a picture and you just put the word rapist over it, and it's like, there you go. In the real world, it's much harder because, oh, look at that nice person. That's a human. Like, oh, it looks like my Aunt Sophie. Oh, she's on the other side of the border. I mean, she's not human, but she looks so human. What? I'm confused. Think about when they can do what they do to us on the net. In real life, that's when the sort of dehumanization that we've been, that's been inflicted on us for the last 20 years of internet living, gets really dangerous. And of course, the solution is as it was back in the early days of capitalism, back when Adam Smith was writing about what to do. It's to remember that the real factors of production in an economy are land, labor, and capital. The place you are, the people who are there, and the investment. where right now the investment, the investors, the capitalists are the only ones getting to make decisions. They undermine municipal government. They undermine human consciousness. They undermine labor. They destroy unions. They don't allow the connectivity. They don't allow us to establish rapport. There's no chat button on an Uber driver's app for him to talk to other drivers about how their day is going. And that's because connecting with other people gives human beings power.
You're also referencing unions here, unions that actually work for the people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, unions have a bad name now because, I mean, everybody's kind of libertarian. But, I mean, unions are, in some ways, now they're almost like this weird goal. But unions really are the baby step towards solidarity. Unions are the structure through which people can then say, oh, you mean I don't have to be ashamed of what I make. Rather, if I let everybody else know what I make and we can compare and contrast, we can bargain collectively. You know, they can't turn us against one another. But right now, I mean, just as our national leaders are convincing us to hate people in other nations so that they can control us, our bosses don't want us talking to one another about, you know, about our experiences. We're all one way or another now. We're all gig workers competing against each other for these little, you know, droppings on Amazon Mechanical Turk or whatever there is to do online, TaskRabbit, or becoming Uber drivers. We really need to reconnect to one another and decide, is this the way that we want things to be? Or do we want to develop alternatives in the places that we live?
And that's the foundation of your book, Team Human. That's what we're speaking about. Douglas Rushkoff, our guest, media theorist, and his recent book titled Team Human versus Team Algorithm, I suppose.
In some ways, Team Algorithm, Team Capitalism, Team Inhuman, Team Mean Guys. you know, it's not even against so much as whatever is Team Human is against whatever is anti-human. You know, I came up with the idea when I was on a panel with this kind of famous transhumanist, this guy who, you know, believes that human beings should upload our consciousness to computers. And once computers pass us an intelligence, that human beings should just fade into the background and accept computers are our evolutionary successors. And I made this, you know, maybe long-winded but heartfelt case for humans that we're special and we're weird and we're funny and we deserve a place in the digital future. And then when I gave that whole case, and then the transhumanist guy said, oh, Rushkoff, you're just saying that because you're a human, as if it was hubris. And that's when I said, okay, fine. I'm on Team Human. You know, I accept, you know, I accept guilty as charged. I'm a human. And that's and reason enough to want a place for humans in the future.
In the film Ex Machina, there's a reference to why seemingly trivial personal data was collected by social media companies. One of the characters in that film says, the composite of all personal social media data was used to program robot behavior and personalities to interpolate being human. Do you suspect AI is set up to fail because of it being modeled from an incomplete model of humans?
Well, it depends what you mean by fail. You know, will it fail at manipulating human beings into a state where we can no longer exercise our autonomy? Maybe not. It might succeed at that. I mean, will it succeed in becoming conscious beings? I don't think so. So if technology and algorithms, if they pass the famous Turing test, which means that you can no longer distinguish between the computer and a person, I don't think it will be because computers have achieved consciousness, but rather because we've gotten so bad at distinguishing between humans and algorithms that we fall for it. And we are getting worse. The more dehumanized we get, the less eye contact we make, the less rapport we make, the more we interact with people through Skype or our smartphone or texting rather than in real rooms, the more we disable these evolved mechanisms for social cohesion.
Oh, that's interesting. So the more that happens, we become more alienated and suspicious of one another and more isolated.
And perhaps counterintuitively, more addicted to the technology. You know, addictions don't work because they actually satisfy you. Addictions work because they don't quite satisfy you. If they really, really scratched the itch, you'd be complete and you could move on. So when you have, and this is, there's a lot of great studies on this, and I talk about them in the book. There's good references to them. But if you have, a Skype conversation with somebody, you know, you see them nod and they say that they agree with you, but your human organism can't really see their pupils dilating as they want to take you in. You can't see their breathing rate sync up to yours. You don't get all of the feedback mechanisms that normally cause your mirror neurons to fire and the oxytocin to go through your bloodstream and for you to establish what we call rapport with the other person. So you end the call and your mind says to you, well, the person says they agreed with me, but I don't really feel it. I don't feel it in my body. So then you think, well, that person must have been lying. We haven't evolved to be able to say, oh, it's because of the medium we were using. Your body doesn't understand from media. It doesn't say, oh, the resolution wasn't good enough. You know, your instinct says they were lying and you don't trust that other person. And you know, and that difference, that inability to establish rapport, that you kind of get it but don't, that you don't really know, that's what makes it more addictive. Then you go back for more and more and more.
Right. One of the, I guess, addictive qualities of gambling, I understand, was being uncertain of the outcome and having it come up one time out of three or one time out of seven, and then the possibility of it coming up existed. You went after that.
So. Oh, yeah. The statisticians who developed the Las Vegas slot machines, I mean, they understood this even before we had computers, you know, when they were just mechanical. They still understood at what ratio we're going to take all their money, but how many quarters do we have to give them back to get them to stay involved in the game? And they realized it wasn't about the quantity of money that you give back. It was about creating a pattern or creating a number or a frequency of paybacks that look kind of like a pattern but don't really make a pattern. Because your brain is going to start to go, okay, I put in five, I do five lost quarters, I win one, I put in three and then get two. Five, oh no, I didn't get one. All right, so it's six and then do one, or maybe it goes five and then three, then six and seven, no, five, two. And your brain, that's when your brain is trying to figure out that pattern, that's what creates the addiction. It's really an obsessive compulsive loop, because learning patterns, that's how we understood nature. That's how we figured out when to plant. Learning pattern recognition is a human survival skill in the wild. You know, like when you're doing whack-a-mole or whatever you would do to be, you know, hunting for things. So the slot machine people figured that out. And then we got computer slot machines, and they started to tweak those algorithms in those slot machines. And then the folks at Facebook and Snapchat said, what if we take those slot machine algorithms and use them on our social networks? What if we use them to feed people stories? So we give them one happy thing for every three bad ones, or five happy things and then one bad one, and then what's going to induce the most addictive usage of the pattern? And there's a guy named Nir Eyal who wrote a book called Hooked, which is the big book in Silicon Valley. Hooked now. And what is Hooked? It's saying how to create obsessive compulsive users of your platform. That's not making people more human. The more obsessively and automatically you're doing something, the more like the machine you are. So we are getting dumber and dumber and more automatic the more we use the technologies, while the technologies are getting smarter and smarter and more deliberate about how they manipulate us.
One of the things that Terrence McKenna would talk about is novelty, and then you're talking about the importance of unpredictability and how that's used against people, but also making people become more predictable?
You know, I talk about this in the book, and I kind of pegged it in this TED Talk I did a couple months ago. What I realized was that when the internet happened, when digital technology happened, we had this realization, really, at least the people who are playing with it, that we can make any future we want, that the future is going to become, in some sense, programmable, but up for grabs. We could design reality in real time. When the money people came, You know, when it went from the internet to this long boom stock market thing, they didn't care about creating a future. They're not creative people. They want to know how to bet on the future. That's what stocks are. You bet. It's funny because I've gone to even corporations and talked to these consultants that go in there, like there's something called the Global Business Network and all of these scenario planning agencies and futurists. Futurists are not telling companies how to make the future. They're telling them what's the most probable future so they can prepare for it. So what they want is to narrow the possibilities. They don't care what happens as long as they know what's going to happen and they can bet on it. So they would rather have a certain future of disaster so then they can bet on it and win, you know, 35-1, than have some possibility of a great future, because then how do they bet? And that's kind of the whole problem. So when they look at human beings, they think, how do we limit novelty? How do we limit autonomous behavior? They want people to behave true to their statistical profiles. So if you're on Facebook, Facebook's using all of your past activities to put you into various statistical buckets, and they can figure out with like 80% accuracy if you're going to go on a diet in the next month, or you're going to realize that you're gay in the next 2 months, or you're going to get divorced in the next 6 months. They know this with 80% statistical certainty. Now, for them, the problem is, what about that other 20%? What about those pesky people who are not behaving true to what we've predicted? How do we get them to do it? Well, that's why if you're in the 80% bucket of people who might go on a diet, you're going to start seeing stuff in your newsfeed about, oh, look, Joe just died from being fat. Or, you know, are you eating good food? Or look what cholesterol does to your bloodstream. Because they want to get that 80% up to 90% or 95%. The problem with that is, as people become more and more predictable, as there's fewer people in that weird creative 20%, we end up with less novel solutions to things. We end up with fewer people saying, hey, what if instead of everyone doing it this way, what if we do it that way? You know, that's the only way we get off automobiles and off cigarettes and off capitalism and off all the things that really threaten species extinction within the next few years.
The implication here is an extinction here if this level of being controlled by algorithms is maintained.
Yeah, I mean, in part because we lack the time, attention, focus, and wherewithal to address systemic issues. That the way the technologies are being used on us, they put us into a mental state that's like the kind of person that drives looking just 5 feet in front of them, you know, and they're right up at the steering wheel. We end up in that very impulsive reaction to what's happening now, what's happening now, what's happening now. I mean, some people, and I'm nothing against our president, but some people might say that he has a day-to-day strategy towards how he's trying to steer the American ship. And that could be seen as you know, symptomatic of mental illness, or it could be seen as symptomatic of the sort of media environment that we're living in that's encouraging us to just think in terms of now, 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 rather than the sort of long-term thinking that we need to think about next month, next year, my child's environment. According to even conservative estimates, we've only got 60 years of topsoil left, you know, if we're going to keep exploiting it the way we are, you know, and we're, you know, some would say, you know, the only way out is through, and we've got to depend on our, you know, genetic engineering companies and chemical companies to come up with new ways to grow food on dirt, you know, but it eventually stops working. You know, life needs life. Plants grow in this stuff called soil. You know, soil is a matrix. It's a complex living thing, and our kind of reductionist, highly technologized, you know, Renaissance era understanding of cause and effect science, this reductive science, is not serving us anymore. We've gotten maximum yield that we can, but at tremendous, tremendous cost. And to be able to look at things holistically and systemically enough in order to, you know, adopt permaculture or holistic psychology or, you know, or Rudolf Steiner methods in school or eye contact in your social life, we're going to have to kind of take our foot off the gas a little bit, you know, and slow down and, you know, have that that pause of experience to get off this thing.
Do you trust an agribusiness company like Monsanto to help humanity through something like that?
I don't trust any shareholder-driven company to help humanity through that, because they understand, and it's not even legal, but people always use the legal argument that, oh, you've got to, you know, do what your shareholders need. That's not even true. But they buy this understanding of a company as in service to the shareholders. The CEO knows he'll get fired if he doesn't deliver shareholder value this quarter. They don't want it next quarter or the quarter after. They want it this quarter. You know, that said, there are some CEOs, like the, I guess he just resigned, but the CEO of Unilever was saying, look, you know, I think we have to start functioning in a different way. And I think we're going to stop giving quarterly reports to our shareholders. And I remember watching this guy on like CNBC or something, and they interviewed him. They said, you're going to stop giving quarterly reports? You're going to lose a lot of shareholders. And he said, yeah, but we'll get different ones. And it was like, wow. And so I don't really know. I can't say, oh, Unilever's great, and that they don't shove, you know, chemicals in little bird's eyes or something, you know, to test their chemicals. I don't know what they really do. But what he was saying was the beginning of a Wall Street-owned company saying, well, maybe we can do something else. It's possible that there's sort of that Buckminster Fuller or someone like that is correct, and that the only way out is through, that we can't, you know, go back entirely to permaculture and hand-intensive farming practices, that we need to look at, well, what do we know about genetic engineering that could help, or what do we know about chemicals and all that could work? But the danger here is we vastly and prematurely oversimplify things. You know, we think we understand stuff that we really don't. And unless we embrace the complexity of these systems and tread ever so carefully, not like the Europeans who came here in Africa and clear-cut forests and created these terrible monocultures. And likewise, if we're going to act like a Monsanto that's going to, you know, fight against Indian indigenous people's rights to the seeds that they've passed down from generation to generation in order to get short-term profit. If you've got a company that's intentionally ruining the topsoil with one chemical so that you have to buy their fertilizer on another chemical, that's really dark, you know, and we can't. We can't until, you know, the same people doing the science are the people who are hoping to help humanity thrive forward.
Do you see that happening? Because we're talking about scientists and scientists who sometimes are paid by the institutions that are causing the problem, and they want the result. So the science can actually craft the result that these companies want, and it's not always truthful.
It's almost never truthful anymore. I mean, the problem is, and, you know, I hate to sound like just some crazy Marxist or something, but maybe I am. I mean, the problem really is that we are totally obedient to the underlying operating system of corporate capitalism, so much so that we don't even recognize it. I love these digital entrepreneurs come on the scene and say, oh, we're going to disrupt everything. We're going to disrupt everything. They don't disrupt everything. The first thing they do when they have their idea is they go to daddy at Goldman Sachs and they say, how do I do this? And Goldman Sachs says, it's okay, son. We'll show you how this works. And here's how you get the VC from this guy at Sequoia Capital, and then you pivot to something else, and then you grow your company on a hockey stick graph, and you leave devastation in your wake by any means necessary. That's not disrupting anything. That's business as usual, accelerated through digital technology.
Because corporations have reached limits and resources to exploit, they've turned on their own kind. I often hear that humans wouldn't do that to their own kind, but you said jokingly, yes, they're turn tested, they are human. But the research on psychopathy has revealed a subspecies of human that among other traits, is lacking empathy. Do you factor this into the Team Human strategy?
Yeah, I mean, let's say that those studies are right and there's this 2 to 3% of people that are kind of, you know, sociopathic or don't experience empathy for others, and that, you know, maybe back in some early warring societies, we needed a few of those dudes to kind of, and they were usually dudes, right? We needed them to just, you know, go kill those people. We're scared of them.
Not now, though. Men and women.
Oh, is it? So the psychopathy gene seems to be equal?
I don't know about equal, but the articles that are out there within the last 5 years are pointing to certain occupations, such as CEOs.
Right. Well, yeah, or presidents. But it was funny, no, because the reason I said male is there's a DA who lives in my town, and what she does is sex crimes. And, you know, those horrible guys, you know, those ones. And, you know, molesters of children and stuff. And I said, so what's the, you know, so I know, I've got a daughter. What's the profile of these people? And she said, well, they're men. And I was like, oh, great. So, I mean, I started to know women. She says, not that I've seen yet.
That's a different issue.
Yes, yeah, so that's a different issue, I guess, yeah. But the sociopath, it's interesting. So even if there was...
Psychopath, specifically.
Right. I mean, mm-hmm. If there was a function for these sorts of humans...
Who mimic emotions. They actually mimic emotions. They don't
right.
feel
Right. Or they become cult leaders and do all sorts of things. I mean, the certain ones have narcissistic personalities, and I've met them, and they can make you feel really good. I mean, what was Charlie Manson or somebody? I mean, these guys, they are effective. But the digital environment really enables them. The digital environment is friendlier to them than it is to us. The digital environment is a non-emotional place. You know, and on the one hand, it's great for people with Asperger's or autism, you know, because they can do things in a systemic way and look at numbers and systems, and, you know, it doesn't require them to establish rapport or to read other people's emotions. They can look at data, and it's a lot easier to go, and even if it's data of that's rapport, oh, the data says their irises are opening, that means they're taking in what I'm saying, I will continue this. Oh, the data says that their face is flushing, this means they're being embarrassed, I will back off on this. You know, it's a place where you can utilize rapport without, you know, actually experiencing it on an emotional level. But capitalism is way better for the psychopath. You know, there's a great book called Columbus and the Cannibals. It was written by one of the first Native American scholars in Native American studies. And he was explaining that the Native Americans thought that white Westerners had a disease. They didn't blame the humans. They said, oh, you know, because they looked at them, they're humans. But why would they come here and kill everybody? Why would they enslave people? Why would they ruin the soil? Why would they do this? They must have a disease. You know, and really, if you look at what that disease is, I'd have to argue that disease is expansionist capitalism. The disease is an economy that needs to grow in order to stay still. That's the way interest works. You have to grow the economy. So they had to come. They had to expand. And that favors a psychopath, because if we're just going to bulldoze your land, if we're going to disconnect you from what you do, if we're going to be able, how can I run a company where I need to send African children into mines at gunpoint in order to get the rare earth metals for my device, which is what we do, a little bit less now than we used to.
Start wars in Afghanistan, aren't those metals also
right.
in...
How can I do that? You know, how can I, you know, not do reparations for the tragedy at Bhopal after, what is this, 20 years now? How can I treat human beings as an externality unless I'm really able to engage in psychopathic thinking? You know, so it rewards that. The fact is, we could, if we had a culture that was biased differently, we could find roles for these people. We really could. I mean, if they're really defective to the point that they just want to stab and kill, whatever, then I don't know. You know, maybe they can be butchers or something for, you know, those who still eat meat or, you know, whatever. You find something that they can do that the rest of us, you know, find distasteful but still want to see happening.
this gets into the resource in the virtual surface area. That's a limited resource as well, I think you mentioned. The digital companies, the digital technology companies, are exploiting. There's only so much attention.
Right. I mean, and that's where the whole thing's going to crash. There's only so much attention. There's only, I mean, there may be almost infinite data because you can look at everything. You know, what side of the bed did I get out of? But there's only so much money you can make off all this data.
I was told recently that studies are showing that EMF is actually addictive as well, the electromagnetic fields. In addition to the psychological element of social media, the reports are also confirmed that EMF exposure causes harmful biological effects. It's not a good business model. Get your demographic addicted, but then they'll decrease in brain function and stop reproducing.
Well, none of these companies have a long-term business strategy. They only care about next quarter. And if they have your information, then they're spending their time and energy not thinking, how do we make devices that don't do this, but how do we change the story? How do we prevent that from getting out? And the way that they do it is they do now test for electromagnetic radiation and all that, and whether or not a phone is or a cellular system or 5G, which I'm really concerned about, whether those things are hurting people. But what they've done is they've managed to get science, I mean, the science industry, to accept heating the brain as the metric for electromagnetic harm. So if your brain got hotter, then it means, oh, there's electromagnetic harm here. But brain getting hotter may not be the only way of measuring whether these waves are doing something to you or not. You know, my brain, I don't think my brain gets hotter when my chest is X-rayed, you know. I mean, maybe it does, but I don't think that's the problem. That's not why X-rays are a problem. So when you use a disingenuous metric to measure the harm of something, I mean, that is the industry, that is capitalism trying to repair the potential damage that's caused by this. It's the same as the cigarette industry, you know, denying addiction for 40 years until they finally did. I mean, and what is their business model? Their product kills, but it kills so slowly that they can still make a lot of money off it in the meantime.
That's a strong example, the thermal versus non-thermal EMF.
Yeah.
And then the past guest was saying that another argument I think government agencies make and corporations make is that they're millimeter waves, especially for 5G, and they will only penetrate millimeters of the skin. But this professor said, no, there is the magnetic element of the electromagnetic field, and that goes all the way through the body. And one example he gave was a case in Switzerland where there were calves in a field around cellular towers, and the calves were being born with cataracts. The microwaves went all the way through the body, not just the millimeter. And he was pointing that out as there will be a serious problem with 5G.
Yep, and the other serious problem for those of us who would like to stop it is these industries are considered too big to fail. You know, they have the power right now, not us. So then the solution will be people starting to wear foil hats and stuff. I mean, actually good, you know, I'm sure they'll have Faraday cage clothing that you can wear to try to block out some of it. And then do you put it on your child or do you try to move out? Or, I mean, there's already a law that says that you're not allowed to contest a cell phone tower based on health.
That's in the Telecommunications Act.
Yeah, so when they do that, when they say, okay, you're not allowed to protest based on health, who gets a law like that passed and how, right? That's because we're not in control of government, because government is really in the hands of corporatists at this point. You know, and in some ways, I mean, you know, in some ways, a dysfunctional government owned by criminals who steal the money intended for the agency is better than an agency that makes laws that are designed to hurt people. So if the agency is a bad actor, then I'm almost at the place where I don't mind them to be dysfunctional.
I hear you, because you're thinking about this and you have children, right?
Right.
So what are you thinking about? The 5G thing is coming pretty quickly, like a year from now, the so-called 20,000 satellites in orbit to be put up in
I have really morbid thoughts. I think things like it's better for her to have had these 14 great years of life and experience and wonder than not to have lived at all. I'm not going to regret bringing her into this world. And I'm rather than bemoaning the future that she might be moving into, I want to celebrate and sanctify the experience that she's gotten to have.
In terms of Team Human, do you see people coming together to stop the worst of it?
People coming together would stop the worst of it. Now, that's the whole point of Team Human. You know, you could say the other team, or we're talking about what's the other team? Let's call it Team RF or whatever, Team EMF. That's a good one. I mean, because then what is it? It's people on the earth with their baby cows that have the cataracts gathering together and saying, look at our baby cows. They have cataracts. Now our babies are going to get cataracts too. I mean, what did we do to this place? You know, what did we do? And I mean, gosh, the impact of humans on all the other species is just, I mean, it's so criminal. And I know I do get in conversations with environmentalists who say, you know, why are you supporting Team Human? Team Humans are the ones that screwed this whole thing up. Humans don't deserve a place. And it's like, yes and no. You know, I get that we did that, but we're alive too. You know, we're alive too, and not all the humans did this. You know, a select group of humans, the same ones who were the feudal lords in the medieval times, who were the mean kings in the Renaissance times, are now these kind of robber baron capitalists in modern times, people who are spending 10 or 20% of their money on bomb shelters, on survivalist camps to go live in. People who are asking me, instead of how do I make a better digital future, people who are asking me, should I put my fallout shelter in New Zealand or Alaska? Who want to know, how do I maintain control of my security force after the apocalypse? They're betting on the bad thing. They've given up. So screw them.
All right. So you have those people.
Yeah.
But you also have the people who are quiet and they're not doing anything and they're letting it happen, hoping somebody else will do something. What do you say to that?
I mean, well, they're quiet because these problems seem so big. You know, how do I stop climate change and all those kind of things? And reason I did this book is to say there is an answer. There is something that you can do, and that's find the others. Engage with other people. That in itself starts the whole ball rolling. Every minute that you spend with another person is a minute you're not buying and selling. It's a minute you're not online. It's a minute you're not being trained by an algorithm. It's a minute that you're restoring your innate capacity for compassion, for intelligence. It's the way that you build a collective mind and establish the rapport and solidarity necessary to actually fight this battle.
What I also hear you saying is that Team Human has to reach a point to nullify the corporate goon infiltrator that will commodify any significant cultural movement, including activism. You mentioned in this book examples, you cite punk rock and raves being victims of that corporate cultural takeover. So the question would be, how does Team Human transcend the corporate death grip?
It is tricky. I mean, as soon as you come up with something, anything that's good and real,
Or effective
sometimes. It ends up at the mall, and it ends up something that you buy. You know, oh, so now buy some climate change gear, you know, or whatever, some hokey thing. And everybody's out, how are we going to sell, you know, value-laden products to millennials that appeal to all of the things that they're doing? I mean, I think what we keep forgetting when we have these moments, these movements, you know, and certainly punk was one of them in a way, rave was, grunge was, these are just cultural movements, or the internet. You know, we forget what is truly political. about it. You know, what was political about Rave, about thousands of kids dancing in an abandoned field, was the reclamation of public space, saying we can party, we're not going to pay anything to anyone, we don't need a nightclub, we don't need a this, we're just going to do this thing. So many things were political about the internet, you know, that we are going to have a medium that is not receive only, a medium that we make, that we're turning one another into the content rather than, you know, buying this corporate drivel from, you know, Time Warner or something. And, you know, we have to understand that human beings in solidarity is highly political as well. In this climate, sitting with another person is revolution. It really, really is. That wait a minute, you're just going to be with someone else. Yeah, you're just going to be with somebody. You're going to be with somebody. Every moment that you spend with that person, I know it's hard, but that you're there and connecting, all of a sudden, all of this stuff, all of these instincts, all of this power begins to rise. And then you find a third person and a fourth and a tenth and a 20th. Then you're a group. This is what Levittown, the Long Island community, was built to prevent people from congregating. It's in the actual design of the plan, because people congregating are dangerous. They knew it then, and it's still true to this day. People connected in the real world are dangerous. When you do it online, you never know. Who owns this platform? How is it being steered? How are my behaviors being manipulated? Maybe do it to find a few people, but then get out there. You know, human beings have the home field advantage on planet Earth. In the real world, we have the home field advantage. Out there in these virtual spaces, we don't.
Getting back to climate change for a minute, what are your thoughts on how much resource, time, and energy is put toward climate change activism, yet that same movement virtually ignores the implementation of zero-point energy solutions? It seems like that would be the real activism worth engaging in.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's, I guess, it's back to this sort of Buckminster Fuller idea. Do we need to just slow down and use less stuff? Or is there some, you know, absolutely renewable energy source based on the whatever it is, the heat of the universe, I guess?
We know there is, and we know that it is sequestered away from the public domain.
Right, because of what it would do to the energy markets. Yeah, well, that's capitalism, isn't it? I mean, it's true in any sphere. But then, so how do I fight that battle? Okay, I can be a person who decides that's the thing I'm going to dedicate myself to. I'm going to find the others who care about this issue and work with them and all. But in addition, the more human and humane humanity becomes, you know, the less and less likely we are to be, you know, hoodwinked and manipulated by control like that. I mean, the question, it's interesting to ask, though. It's like, if the billionaires were at the very precipice and they say, oh, wow, planet Earth's really going to end now, would they unleash it or not? You know, whoever's holding it, you know, would they or not? I'm interested. But I would think that alternative universities and research centers and people could start developing this if it's you know, if it's going to require, you know, massive capital on the level of like nuclear power plants to build.
It does. It actually does. I've looked at some of this.
Then it's really hard, because those are not the people who want it, the people who have that kind of money. You know, it would have to become some giant collectivist thing, and then there'd be try it once, and then all the people would get scammed out of their money, and it would become a, you know.
Which has already happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's not my issue, but I did meet a woman who was from some organization that's like, you know, zero point publicity and trying to gather all the people together and who know about this. And I was like, wow, I sure hope that's real.
What are the upsides to the internet right now that is very hopeful?
I mean, the upside is that you look how people are using the internet now. They're using it for podcasts. Everybody's got podcasts. You know, it's like we're using the internet to bring back radio. Isn't that sweet? You know, most of the spectrum got bought up by Clear Channel. You know, there's only one BAI and one FMU and one KPFK. There's very few community radio stations out there. But my gosh, there's millions of podcasts, aren't there? And people talking. And I love that we're using the internet to reify the voice. The voice and sound do something that pictures don't. You know, TV is different. Pictures are different. I remember when, when Trump was talking about all these, these refugees coming from Mexico and the caravan and the horrible people and all that. And people are believing it and believing it and believing it. And then came that tape of the sounds of the children crying in the detention centers. And that's what forced action, that people heard it, because on an instinctual level, sound does something that the visual doesn't. You can't be objective with sound. It's a heart medium. It's what McLuhan would say, it's a hot medium versus a cool medium like television. That was something. So, I mean, I love that that's going on. I still love, places like Reddit and Quora and the places that look like the old net, that look like Usenet, that look like people just thinking and bringing their higher selves, not behaving impulsively on a social network, thumbs up, thumbs down, tweet this, blah, 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 blah. But, like the old days on the net when you would read a forum, you would sit overnight crafting one paragraph and then upload it to the net the next day. And the net became this place where people sounded smarter than they do in real life. So much so that they were almost scared to meet people who they talked to online because they knew how smart they sounded. They say, oh no, when they meet me, they're going to realize I'm just this. Could you imagine an internet, that profoundly dignified and smart?
Well, you mentioned podcasts. Can you tell listeners about your podcast, please?
Yeah, I do a podcast called Team Human, which was the inspiration for the book. I mean, I came up with the podcast first, and then I was like, the ideas I'm sharing in these monologues and the solidarity that we're forging is something that really needs to be stated. We need a kind of manifesto for this. But originally I started it because, I'm over 50, and I've written 20 books, a bunch of graphic novels. I've had the stage for a long, long time. And I decided to do the podcast really for two reasons. One, and most importantly, to use the platform I've developed to give voice to other people who needs to be heard that doesn't have the kind of audience. If I can bring, even if it's only my 40,000 listeners to somebody, that's something. It's more than they had the day before. So celebrate other people's work and achievements. And also because I've spoken so much, I want to listen. I want to hear. I want to learn. Team Human is also, it kind of chronicles my own exploration of what does it mean to be human in this bizarre digital capitalist age, and how do we reify humanity in all of these different sectors of life.
Douglas Rushkoff, author of the recent book Team Human, thank you so much for doing this book, for putting it together. It's really inspiring and hopeful. And thanks for being on In Other News.
Well, thanks for doing the show. I know you do it not just for the money.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.